he crowds me.
Lousy cops.
Always crowding the guy.
Back off, boys.
Don't crowd me.
Don't crowd me, Joe. Don't crowd me. Don't crowd me, Joe. Don't crowd me.
You just learned something. No one
it's
crowds
a joke.
Me,
Joe.
Nobody crowds me, Joe.
So big $2.
$2, where are you putting them, gold dust?
Another big spender, eh?
Don't crowd me, dishwasher.
Do you know who Tyler Durden is?
Durden.
There's an article in Digital Trends about concerns that some people using plugging external hard drives, including from Western Digital, into Macs that are running Mavericks OS 10.9, are like having problems with like data loss or accessibility to their drive and stuff.
That's horrible.
Yeah, so definitely a warning out there. I don't know how many people are actually affected by this, but if you do backup onto external hard drives, don't go plugging them in right now. There might be a fix in a upcoming version of Mavericks. The article says it's not just Western Digital drives. But like people's stuff is getting like renamed and partitioned without their consent.
I mean, I think working in technology, you know that it's not flawless.
Right.
I mean, code is a living, breathing beast. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so many times I talk to developers and I'd be like, well, what do you mean it's not doing what it's supposed to do? And they're like, I don't know. And I'm like, what do you mean? You programmed it. Well,
yeah, unexpected behavior. Yeah,
you know,
very common.
The best of things can go wrong. And it just is a good reminder that when you're upgrading to any system, you should really have a whole process of backing everything up.
Mm-hmm.
And having, you know, maybe a test external hard drive. And, you know, I mean, I get it. It's one more thing to think about. But when you're talking about your data and, you know, security and new software and stuff coming out, I mean, you have to take precautions and be careful. And this is just a good way for all of us to look at our upgrading processes and how we do things and just to be more vigilant of it.
Yeah, you want to have multiple copies of your backup. So if one drive goes south, hopefully you have another copy of it. But yeah, I mean, backing up's already pretty difficult. Now people are being told, you know, maybe don't, like just lay off doing that backup for a little while. I'm hoping that a new version or two will get us, you know, a version that works, that doesn't have any conflict. But so hold off on doing those backups. If you're listening to this one, it's still the early days of OS X Mavericks. Because right now we're recording on November 9th, 2013. And this is the Pacific Pelican iOS/64 podcast with me, Dan McKeown, and with the lovely Jessica.
Hi, everyone.
And you can find the show notes by just going to the website, looking for the podcast number. And there'll be some links to some of the stuff we're talking about, including that article in Digital Trends. And, like, you know, you talk about having to back up your data. Like, Chris Berman, like, let's just say he didn't back up his data, like, what would it sound like if, like, Chris Berman from ESPN had to deal with data loss of his, you know, important football-related data?
I bet he would go on a crazy rant and would be really pissed.
Why does everyone all of a sudden have to move? I've had 2 fucking hours to move around. Wait 10 minutes. Jesus. I'm sorry to explode by that, but it's like no one's ever worked on TV here before. Jesus. Chucking under the kid. What the fuck do they think I'm doing?
I want to talk to you.
I actually can't believe what I just saw.
No.
It's like no one here has worked on TV before. I hear a dial tone. seven people. I mean, Jesus.
Yeah, so I mean, if seven people got in the way of his backup, I don't know, that might sound like that.
Yeah. What happened in that situation?
Well, yeah, that actual clip, it's apparently around 2000. I think in the year 2000, the Monday Night Football package involved Chris Berman doing anchoring from the studio, or maybe this was because I think at the time Monday Night Football was on ABC, so maybe he was working, you know, for that, or maybe it was a lead in on ESPN, you know, for and they also I'm not sure how, you know, but anyway, he's one of their big announcers. And apparently, people were ducking under the camera right in front of him. Like, so actually, because based on his rant, it sounds like that's one of the things he says. He's mad. Someone's being unprofessional. There's, you could have moved at any time. Like, I guess you know, he's doing a show probably at halftime while the game isn't going on, right? Because he's not in the announcer booth. He's, like, at the anchor desk. So he's flipping out. And I'm not sure if, I think this might have been recorded because they're just running tape. But I don't know that this actually made it out onto the TV broadcast. So this might have been leaked even, like, you know, later than that. but yeah, I mean he now I understand that, you know, part of being professional is, you know, dealing with other people sometimes not being professional. Like, there's just these people walking around his studio and he doesn't feel like things are, you know, in the right kind of, you know, in the right kind of mode. And so, but he's flipping out, and it's like, but I got to admit, it is pretty annoying when people try to duck under the camera.
Yeah.
You know, like, well, if you have a video camera or something, and it's some event, like, it, you know, it's not like you're walking around into someone's backyard. Like, it's people, you're at some, like, public event, and people are, like, right in the front row, and then you're, you know, standing in front of, like, whatever you're videoing, you know, and they'll duck under it. Like, why? Why do you duck under?
And sometimes they get caught on camera ducking, so they look really awkward.
Usually, because they don't really know they're not likely to know the focal distance of that camera. They're not going to figure it out. It's people, right? Like, and what looks more awkward? People, like crab walking at the bottom of your picture, or people just walking in front of something like people do, you know, like when you do enough video, you realize that there's going to be situations where people are going to walk in front of your camera shot, you know, when you're trying to video something. That's why you use multiple cameras if you can, or, you know, whatever. Right. But it happens. Like, it's not that big a deal.
Yeah, and I mean, I was just watching some video, actually, and there was a really horrible reflection in one of the videos I was looking at, where you could see the cameraman, but just, like, from the, you know, neck to maybe the knees, and then there was another one with, like, a bobbing microphone, and I was just like, people, you know, like, check your shots, and, you know, do a test run and know where that microphone needs to be. And I think what I think happens sometimes is people set up the camera and they don't look through the viewfinder because they think they've got it about right, and then they're trying to engage the person, you know, so they're trying to be the interviewer and the camera person at the same time.
Yeah, now I understand, you know, like, a lot of times you don't have that many people for a task, but that really doesn't work if you're trying to be the producer and the cinematographer, right? You kind of got to be one or the other if you want to excel at it.
Yeah. Otherwise you get Bobby microphones and bad reflections.
Right. So we talked a little bit. We saw some stuff about the mayor of Toronto. You think? I don't know. We could see if this video is any good, or should we just explain what happened? Because I think everybody's probably heard about it.
Well, he finally admitted to smoking to rock.
Yeah, exactly. Let's see if John Stewart's take on this.
I remember a few months back.
No, I'm not. That's bullshit.
It looks like they did it off of Canadian TV. I don't know. It's a
CTV. It says CTV. It's you're right. It's some other country. Probably, like you said, maybe Canada. But that it's actually surprisingly popular, like those shows, I think, in a lot of other countries. Now, I guess it's not that surprising because a lot of people follow American news. So actually, this is the video that this is the one where it kind of goes to, there's another layer of the story. So, like, anyway, you perfectly summed up the first part of the story. This guy, the mayor of Toronto, Rob Ford, there's a video of him smoking crack. A bunch of shady stuff happened.
Yeah.
And now he's finally admitted it. So something must have forced his hand. Like, he had to be, so he lied. I mean, because I personally, you know, I've never tried crack, but I don't really care if someone smokes crack. Like, I actually think that the negative effects of those drugs are considerable, but still the worst effect of those things is getting caught up in the justice system. You know, like, it's just somebody's, like, behavior. But he lies about it. Why can't you just admit it? Why can't, no, because he had to lie about it for like, you know, all that time. And I think that was kind of, I mean, I think that was some shady shit right there.
I think that speaks more to his character than smoking crack.
Yeah, exactly.
Although smoking crack's pretty horrible, and I don't know if I want my mayor to be smoking crack.
That's reasonable enough, I guess. Like, it is, you know, it does seem like a dangerous thing. But, you know, it's just one of those things that's more of like a personal character issue that I think maybe voters might be willing to get over. Like, the same way, the same way politicians can sometimes survive having affairs or other things like that if they're honest about it.
I think if he was smoking weed, they'd be like, okay.
Oh, yeah, but that's not nearly as big a deal.
There's a shadiness that goes with crack. I mean...
Yeah, I think so.
Pretty much everybody smokes weed. What is it, like a 57% approve of it?
Yeah, 58 or 57 or so percent of the country now wants it legalized. So even though, according to some surveys, it's like 10, 15% of the country smokes it or has smoked it recently, like maybe more higher percentage has tried it at some point. It's even people who don't do it have decided, you know, like they know someone probably who does it. And, you know, these days it's a very mainstream thing. It's just it's a very mild kind of, you know, therapeutic type of medicine. It's not something that really the reefer madness hype really, I mean, that's just finally lost steam. People are just finally more real about it.
And I just don't see that happening for crack. You know, I mean, I think it's going to stay in its PR, you know, area there.
Cocaine and crack definitely still have, like, a lot more questions. They seem to be, like, genuinely dangerous. Yeah, and it's just weird that for so many years people would talk about drugs like crack and cocaine next to stuff that's, like, you know, weed and you know, other, you know, less harmful substances.
Yeah. Let's see what John Stewart has to say.
Yeah.
He's a good man. He's one of our favorites, Patrick Stewart. As you know, all week we've been following Toronto Mayor Rob Ford as he's been filming the footage for what we assume will be his forthcoming VH1 Behind the Music episode. Rob Ford was riding high as mayor of Toronto. But how high, no one had any idea. Of course, for quite some time, Rob Ford had been denying that he was a smoker of crack cocaine. He recently amended that statement slightly on Tuesday.
Yes, I have smoked crack cocaine.
Oh, crack cocaine! I thought you would ask, have you tried Jack LaLanne? Or hijacked a plane, or if there are any blacks in Maine. That's what I thought. It's, my hearing is not good, what with all the crack smoking. Now, I am sure that people who love Rob Ford have tried to make Rob Ford go to rehab, to which he has apparently replied again, and this is, of course, speculation, no, no, no. And he has, seemingly as mayor, survived his crack
too soon for
admission.
An Amy Winehouse reference.
What's
going to
test his ability to stay in?
I guess, but they were referencing her work and not her.
A brand new video of the crack smoking mayor of Toronto, Rob Ford.
Don't you kill the guy? I'm talking to surgery minor, the noble department. He dies right now. But he's down there. I'll rip his throat out. I'll pull his eyes out. When he's dead, he'll make sure that mother's dead.
All right. Well, I don't know what he was saying, but it clearly looks like outtakes from Tommy Boy. Look, this guy, this is where it's going. This, first of all, by the way, terrible camera work. Has it occurred to Mayor Rod Ford that all these videos of him smoking crack and acting crazy are an indication that even his friends are going, no one's going to believe this? And he's so like, oh my God. It's clear to me now that he smokes crack to calm himself.
I need 10 minutes to make sure he's dead. It'll be over 5 minutes. Right? It'll be a bad. I didn't want to sick my dude. Can't wait.
By the way, PolitiFact rated that last statement from the mayor true.
Yeah, so that other video included was him kind of, from what we can tell, kind of ranting about maybe an opponent in some kind of wrestling ring.
I mean, he's definitely, it sounds like he's making threats, at the beginning it sounds sort of like a death threat, and by the end it sounds like he keeps saying the word brother and talking about in the ring like he thinks he's Hulk Hogan or some shit.
And I think there was an interview we saw with his mom and his sister. You know, his sister, I think she says, well, I was an addict. Well, I am an addict. And it's like, well, which one is it? So there's probably some sort of history of addiction and substance abuse maybe in the family.
Well, it sounds like, I mean, his sister is coming out like, I don't know, getting out in front of this story by... Like, I should play that clip. It's so ridiculous. I mean, it's like, you're right. She's basically saying, look, I know what an addict is because I'm an addict. And somehow that qualifies me to disqualify, you know, to exclude my brother from the cohort of addicts. You know what I mean? Like, she's claiming she can rule him out because she can rule herself in. Like, I'm not really sure if that's the clinical process.
Yeah, and I feel like she also mentioned something about, like, you know, him getting really drunk or something, and she like kicked him out, or I don't know if that. Well, you know, if you want to play.
Oh it, yeah, like basically saying like he was at her house. He got wasted, drunk, and unruly, and so she kicked him out. So presumably onto the roads of Canada.
Well, I feel like she used the word like blasted or something, like some really great like wasted, drunk.
Right, which is like the sister and mother of the mayor who were in this interview that I guess we could play right now. They have a strange kind of affected kind of. All right, I don't know. It's not even worth getting into, but don't they seem to have kind of a strange like posh English kind of pretension? Do you know what I mean? As like, I don't know. They have a weird vibe for Canadians. You know what I mean? If you think about people from Canada, typically, you know, like, they just seem like they're trying to pose as, like, very upper class, like, sitting on their couches and stuff. Like, you know, kind of like two-bit medieval, Middle East dictators.
They've been prepped, for sure, by his people, I'm sure.
Yeah, you're right. TV is so... You're right, I remember...
We're not going to let the sister and the mother go talk with... I mean, that was a ploy, I think, to be like, hey, we're his family, and hey, you know... Because the mom is like... He did something bad, and he apologized.
You're right.
Whatever, it's done.
Well, the mother has a very stiff kind of vaguely patrician kind of manner to her. You know what I mean? Like, but it's strange because, I mean, yeah, like it's not.
And the mother and the daughter, like, they don't even make eye contact. You can feel the distance between the two of them, even.
But for whatever reason, they're circling the wagons, and they're both doing this interview on this couch. It's very strange.
Yes.
So it's from CNN, but we'll play this clip here, and you can find a link to the actual video in the show notes. But you know, it's like, I remember being told by my communication professor in grad school that, you know, that people... from the news channels, even local news, everything is very, very packaged and slick. If they call you, they'll be on your lawn in like 10 minutes. They're going to like, do you know what I mean? They're going to figure out the angles. They're going to have a story they're going to tell about you. And it's, you have to be like ready because they're going to basically feed you the lines that they want for their 1 minute segment. You know what I mean? And your 2 second part in it.
Yes, exactly.
Professor Bell's.
Well, they didn't have to wait very long. After admitting to smoking crack, quote, in one of my drunken stupors, end quote, a video surfaced today showing, at the very least, one such alcohol fueled episode. I'll show you the video in just a moment. The Toronto Star bought the video. Neither they nor we know the precise context of it. Mayor Ford himself does not say, telling reporters only that he is embarrassed now and was, quote, extremely, extremely inebriated when the video was made. Again, this is not the crack smoking video. This is another video entirely. For many who have watched the video, the mayor seems more than extremely inebriated. Way more. Here it is.
Okay, so we've already had clips of this.
Who the hell is that? I've got the strongest feeling someone's gonna kick his ass.
All right, so we're skipping. Now here's the interview.
His sister and mother went on Toronto's CP24 speaking to reporter Stephen LeDrew.
Robbie is not a drug addict. I know because I'm a former addict, or an addict, if you would want to say. And as an alcoholic, if you want to consider binge drinking once every 3 months and you get totally plastered, which he just makes himself full of himself, and I've even asked him to leave my own at one time I saw him. Fine. It's not acceptable behavior.
He is the mayor of the city. Every 3 months or so, just getting plastered.
You say he's not going to resign.
No.
And he's going to tough it out.
Yeah, he did what he did. He made a mistake. He's admitted to the mistake. Not a nice one, but he's done it.
Yeah,
he is.
Mother.
He's been to work every
single
day.
It's a joke.
Day.
It's a fucking joke.
People want to say that, oh my goodness, you know, he's ignoring council, or he's ignoring his job at City Hall. Right. He isn't.
You take that back.
Kathy Ford talking to CP24 Stephen LeDrew.
I mean, you know, it's just it's pretty much a train wreck, and for some reason the mother and sister are involved too, and I guess maybe they benefit from his, you know, his position, so they want him to stay in, right? Because the mother was very, she was like, he made a mistake, but he's staying in, you know, it was very, like, you know, two different directions. You know, I sometimes I want to read PDFs on my iPhone, you know, it's possible to send PDFs to Kindle, and it used to be with iBooks, and there might still be a way, but iBooks kind of works differently now that it's been also added to the Mac anyway. So I was looking for a way to read PDFs, and I was like, well, I found this free application. It was currently free, and actually, you know, I wasn't looking for just free. I wouldn't mind spending a couple bucks, but it's a good application. This one, it's called NeoSOAR Reader. NeoSOAR, and it basically has an iBooks derived kind of wooden case for your books, but then it has the ability to just go, you can take a PDF on your desktop, and you can plug your you can plug in your iPhone to iTunes, and then you can just upload the PDF that you want to read, and it'll appear in this app.
That sounds cool. So, what PDFs do you have in there right now?
I have these tech books. So a couple books about JavaScript. So I have the PDFs of the books. So I wanted to be able to consult. Now, I think this, like some of these books, the real way to do this might be using an iPad. Because here, I mean, I can actually read this really small type, but it's pretty small.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's cool though. I mean, there's some PDFs that have bigger type and it can zoom, you know, but I was just saying, like, with iPad, this might work even better for like almost any kind of PDF. So, you know, you can organize, just because people are used to the iBooks or Kindle app metaphor where you kind of have a row of books and you can just pick the book you want to read now. And like, so this is a way, like, those things kind of support PDFs as like second class, you know, citizens compared to their native formats, you know, whereas, so this is a way to give your PDFs like their own kind of, you know, home on your phone, and it'll remember the page you're on, you know, like sometimes that won't happen on those other, you know, readers that are designed for their own ebooks mainly.
I've only used like one page PDFs on the iBook version, but I opened up a PDF and it went right into the iBooks, so I thought that was nice.
Yeah, you know, on the desktop now, iBooks is going to allow you to, I think, put PDFs into it and organize. So if you want to have like a desktop place to organize your PDFs, that the iBooks app is good. But for iOS, the iBooks app, it may not. I'm not sure it's really the PDF solution now for, you know, for mobile. So something like Neos or gives you a chance to, read. And I think it might support other formats too, but it definitely supports PDF pretty well. So that was what I got it for.
Cool.
There's the magazine Guns and Ammo, which whenever I'm in a convenience store that has a lot of like beef jerky and pork, like links up at the front, you know, and maybe one of those no cash video poker machines, you know.
Yeah.
They'll probably have Guns and Ammo displayed pretty prominently in the magazine rack. Right. So, you know, when I see that, I don't know. I don't really think much of it. Like, there's usually a gun on there on the cover, and then they write about guns. And you know what? There's apparently a term of art. Well, they use it in this post that I want to talk about. There's a term called gun writer. You ever heard that?
No.
That has an interesting sound to it. Gun writer. Well, one of the gun writers on that magazine, Guns and Ammo, wrote a column where he talked about regulation and how all rights are subject to regulation, and so it was a pretty moderate position, but it was, you know, it was making a more nuanced position than the typical rigid doctrinaire kind of views of the gun rights movement. I don't really think that Second Amendment movement is the right term, because the gun rights absolutists have gone way beyond the Second Amendment. The Second Amendment is about the federal government and whether they can, you know, curb firearm ownership. But the states, it's been widely, you know, litigated that the states have the right to regulate guns. So, you know, if a state wants to, you know, outlaw certain types of guns or put regulation into it, you know, there's you know, room for that to be done in the Constitution. And the absolutists are wrong that there's some sort of, like, you know, absolute right. And, you know, and there are nuts that have views, like, you know,
the United States is based on guns.
But, you know.
Yeah.
So this is Guns and Ammo. The editor, Jim Bequette, he says, quote, "As editor of Guns and Ammo, I owe each and every reader a personal apology. No excuses, no backtracking." Dick Metcalf's backstop column in the December issue has aroused unprecedented controversy. Readers are hopping mad about it, and some are questioning Guns and Ammo's commitment to the Second Amendment. I understand why. Let me be clear. Our commitment to the Second Amendment is unwavering. It has been so since the beginning. Historically, our tradition in supporting the Second Amendment has been unflinching. no strings attached. It is no accident that when others in the gun culture counseled compromise in the past, hardcore thinkers such as Harlan Carter, Don Cates, and Neil Knox found a place and a voice in these pages. When large firearms advocacy groups were going soft in the 1970s, they were prodded in the right direction, away from the pages of, quote, guns and ammo, unquote. That's an actually, I think that's a lovely typo right there, you know, because it actually is, anyway, so it's not very well written, but anyway, so he says, in publishing Metcalf's column, I was untrue to that tradition, and for that I apologize. His views do not represent mine, nor, most important, guns and ammo. It's very clear to me they don't reflect the views of our readership either. Dick Metcalf has had a long and distinguished career as a gun writer, but his association with guns and ammo has officially ended, unquote.
Whoa. Telling the world that you're fired? If it's a column, I'm guessing it's an opinion.
Absolutely, piece. Absolutely. And he talked about how he wanted to start a debate, and then he kind of admits that was a terrible idea to try to have any kind of debate. You know, it's like, the guy was not taking the kind of position. It wasn't like they gave the back page over to me with, you know, like, you know, my views on gun control, which is that, you know, gun ownership should be rare and, you know, highly licensed and completely insured.
You can link your Starbucks account and your Twitter account, and you can tweet somebody a coffee. I think if you include @tweetacoffee and maybe some kind of hashtag as well, I think the other person might have to have a Starbucks account also. I'm not quite sure how the exchange works. But you can... I don't think they have to. I think you can just tweet them, and then it'll come out of your Starbucks account, and they'll get, like, a coupon, you know, code that they can print out or show on a mobile phone. And for Starbucks, and to be able to do commerce like that on Twitter, you can, you know, and the whole idea is, like, you can tweet to people that you don't know, like, you know, just people you follow that you're a big fan of. And it's this really, like, nice price point of, you know, about $5 or so for a cup of coffee. And it's interesting, like, maybe people are like, I don't know if I want to pay, you know, a $5 donation for, you know, the tweets and the information that I read, but maybe I tweet you a coffee or something. So it's an interesting concept. And I think with the Twitter IPO happening, it'll be really interesting to see where they take this advertising and how they do it carefully. I think they've done a decent job of it. You know, I think they manage the swell of, you know, just always immediate, no, because nobody wants more ads. But, you know, they're doing it in a way that is maybe sustainable and at least a little bit more integrated. I mean, I think, you know, we've just come to realize that there's just going to be ads pretty much everywhere.
Yeah, we talked recently about ads on Instagram. Do you think Twitter is going to be able to become profitable? Because now, you know, their IPO has happened, and at this point their shares are at $41.65, which puts their market cap apparently at about $19.68 billion, so close to $20 billion company, very substantial market cap. But the question is, are they going to be able to grow to where, like, Facebook is now at like $115 billion or so market cap? Like, are they going to be able to rival companies like that with their growth, with their advertising? Do you see them pushing into profitability in the next couple of years?
If they innovate for their users, so they've done a lot of innovation for their advertisers. But they haven't done too much for their users, right? So, okay, yes, they added photos and video, and now the photos are inline. But those aren't innovations. I mean, they're just sort of they're new for Twitter, but they're not new to the space. So I'm curious to see what else they can do with this platform. And if they do it right, yeah, I think they could.
That, you know, that sounds like, you know, it sounds like you're putting it on them. So they gotta be the ones to come up with some new ideas. Now you're saying, like, it's not easy. It's not gonna be easy. Like, if they're able to use the opportunity they have, they have this shot at becoming profitable.
Yeah, I mean, I think they need to be a little bit more human, you know, so they've really done this big advertising push.
Every day we work.
And, you know, Dick Costolo is not a warm and fuzzy kind of guy. But, so they need to bring back a more friendly, approachable face of Twitter.
Yeah, now that they did the IPO, right? Because we were talking earlier before we were recording, you were saying that Dick Costolo brought probably a more polished kind of style to the Wall Street road shows compared to the way it happened with Facebook and Mark Zuckerberg.
Yeah, I mean, you can just see that, like, Dick Costolo would invent something called the Dick Bar. You know, like, you can see that he doesn't really care about the users. He wants to make money. And that's what he's there for. He's there to make them money. You know, didn't he start off as their, like, CFO?
Or maybe COO or something.
Yeah,
but he came from FeedBurner previously.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he's basically, like, a business guy in the tech field, right? Like, so you know, you have to have certain kind of leaders at certain kind of points in the company if you want to have success.
Yeah, and so I think, you know, if they push the innovation, and that's, I mean, I think that's really true for any company that wants to stay ahead in their industry and ahead of the game has to invest in innovation. You know, you want to be the first to do it, and you want to do it great. So keep innovating. And where does innovation come from? I mean, it's a mix of listening to your customers and really being in touch with them, and then also, you know, knowing your industry and knowing your product and knowing the trends and where it's going and putting those two together and hearing what all my customers want, where is this market going, you know? Because you can create the craziest, you know, coolest out there thing, but if nobody's going to buy it, then it's just a crazy thing, you know? Whereas if you create something really cool and different and people want to buy it and you've solved their problems, then you've got something magical. And I don't know, I mean, I guess, I mean, I was a little disappointed that that Twitter, like, does the inline photos now. I mean, part of Twitter was creating this really crafty response that was like, can I get someone to actually click on this link? Am I a good enough, you know, writer? And can I create something crafty and funny and intriguing enough that as they're flipping through their feed, they're going to go, ooh, I'm curious about that, you know?
Yeah.
Now, and it,
the visual part comes right through instead of having to be kind of sold by the words.
It changes the punchline,
It
you
does
know?
Change the interface greatly. And they're privileging their built-in photo system now, finally, over other stuff. Like, for a while, a lot of Twitter stuff would show Flickr inline, but the new way that things are set up on the website, and I think the iOS app as well, is that the Twitter built-in photo is the one that shows in line.
Yeah.
You still have to click for Flickr. Because remember, they've been very friendly toward Flickr for a while, and because that's my, you know, main photo sharing service. But you know, I mean, it's always changing, isn't it? Yeah, you know, it's like crazy. So, and sometimes when these changes happen,
wait,
like,
a minute. Just, this isn't my world.
I mean, it just, to me, it's, Twitter was always the, I mean, there's still the crazies on Twitter and the hashtag and all those, you know, things I like about myself, hashtag 2013, whatever, you know, and there's that whole universe there. But I mean, from a sort of technology and a media standpoint, There was a sophistication to Twitter. There was a we don't need fancy photos. That's for Facebook.
It was a
Facebook's
coral reef.
Like,
yeah.
Just put up a photo and people will like it and people like photos. Mm-hmm. And Twitter, you had to be a little bit more crafty and you only had 140 characters. And you know, so now that everything's inline, it's like, well, am I on Facebook or, you know? So now it's like, are people just going to start posting photos and not putting anything into the words and the crafting of Twitter? I mean, it'll be interesting to see where that goes, you know. It's like, I'm trying to think of an example, but it's starting to get that, like a just dump everything effect. Oh, well, now people can see photos, mm-hmm. I can just dump a bunch of stuff on there. And
people push a lot of stuff to it. I think what happened was when they made it harder to get the data out, people started pushing more data in, and now it's kind of being suffocated by, like every different service can push to Twitter automatically, whatever you do. Oh, I just, you know, like whatever your website is doing. Like I just posted a comment here, or I just, you know, added a new, you know, Instagram photo here. Like it's just updating people about everything. And, you know, like, there's definitely a backlash about the YouTube comments too, that I'm kind of jumping around, but
yeah, no, but it's in the same vein, you know, right. It's social media is kind of always changing and evolving. And, sometimes we don't always think that these big, huge companies are doing the right things. And so now with Google, with YouTube, you have to have a Google Plus account to comment.
Yeah.
And the idea is that the Google Plus account is tied to your real name, so this should stop some of the spammy things. And then, you know, you'll have your friends who are in your circles, you know, those comments will show up higher. And I guess what I want to say is, how many people really have that many friends on YouTube that are watching their stuff?
Well, I think YouTube is one of those online-centric communities, so most of the people that other people, like what people, YouTube users, most of the people they subscribe to are probably people they don't know, right? People they saw on YouTube. So it is a different kind of community, and you're right, they try to ground Google Plus in the real world by real names and association with Google account. A lot of people use Gmail. So it's instead of the more throwaway nature of the YouTube account. Like I do think they're doing this wrong. I think that some of the criticism about YouTube comments being, you know, just it's all, you know, like the image, the stereotype that it's all trolls and it's all garbage, I think that's a little outdated. I don't really like, I think the voting system and some of the changes they had already made to the comment system had allowed videos that had a lot of comments to allow the community to kind of vote stuff up and down. And a lot of times I think, you know, the judgment of the community was fairly reasonable. But now, like you said, they're trying to they're trying to shoehorn the whole thing into Google Plus. So what I think is, like, first of all, a lot of people have connected with people they know through, like, you know, Google accounts onto Google Plus, but they don't use it much. Now people are going to see people's YouTube comments show up probably in the Google Plus stream. Is that really the place for it, right? Like, if you're making a comment, like about someone that you know only online or don't really know but watch their videos, is that really relevant to your friends and family who are in the Google Plus circles or whatever, right? And the idea that, yeah, like, this whole idea that enough people are going to go, that have each other in circles are going to go and have these private conversations under the videos, like, that, and then they're going to push. Also, they talked about pushing community members, like, well, high-profile community members higher up in the comments. So now it's just going to be a weird kind of comment soup out of order based on, like, you know, how important people are according to, you know, Google+.
And you can still choose the recency option, so you can see who commented most recently.
But they don't have the voted up and down comments anymore, do they? Like, that, I kind of start... And then the other problem is you can't vote comments up and down. Like, you used to be able to vote not only on, you know, thumbs up and thumbs down on videos, but then also on comments. And, you know, like, I think... Like, that was a way where you could, you know, people wouldn't have to comment. They could just see if someone already said what they thought. Because a lot of these videos, like, how much is there to argue about? You know, it's just some nutcase in a shabby room yakking at their webcam.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, and I think just like any business, you know, you have to keep telling a story and you have to keep doing things. And with technology, you know, your product is digital, so you're changing things and, you know, you kind of want to have that constant thing to be talking about and doing things, and sometimes maybe people do things just to do it, you know? I don't know what else YouTube users will really want, but wonder how the YouTube Music Awards went.
You know, I saw some pretty tepid reviews of it.
Yeah.
And people, you were so right. You were so right. People kept talking about Kia. Like you know, people in the reviews, they kept talking about how the frequent presence of the Kia brand.
In a positive way or a negative way?
I mean, it felt like they were kind of flogging it, I guess, it sounded like. But, you know.
Well, that, I mean, you know, for a brand to open themselves up, that's pretty harsh, you know. And I wish that the YouTube advertising team had done a better job of integration. Because, I mean, I think Kia tries to be kind of like a cooler brand.
Well, they used to be really affordable. And now I think they have to try to have, like, marketing and image, because there's always going to be a new company with the most affordable car, right? You got to try to move up.
They had those commercials with, like, the hamsters driving, right?
Yeah, I think those were the ones they were pre-rolling on that, on the YouTube Music Award videos that we were looking at a few episodes ago. And I think they had some, like I can look up the names of we can just look up the review or something, like, and see, because there were some people that were on, you know, there, but it's all right. So BuffaloNews.com, their headline asks, first YouTube Music Awards. Okay. First YouTube Music Awards favor anarchy over formula, but to what end?
Dun dun dun.
So, you know, it was like, I mean, yeah, they had to talk about the Harlem Shake. See, here's the problem. YouTube is very much like, it's a fast-moving thing, right? It's online. It isn't about, like, seasons and schedules. People that want to be noticed, they tend to make a new video every week, because there's always new stuff on it, right? So, Harlem Shake, are people really still talking about that, you know? And then here it says, this article says, quote, perhaps even more significantly, the show is a complete mess, an off-the-cuff anti-glamour affair hosted by actor Jason Schwartzman and comedian Reggie Watts that teetered on the edge of anarchy and breakdown. That made it fun, but will it last? Oh, unquote. The next line, quote, well, it's doubtful that the folks behind the MTV Video Music Awards are worried, unquote. The folks. You know, why do people use that word, like, folks? What is with that shit?
I think it's a slight put down.
Is it? And it's I guess it's like literally, very literally trying to be folksy.
Yes.
You know, but it really falls short. I think that maybe there's some southern regions of the U.S. or wherever where it culturally kind of fits, you know, with. But in, I mean, this is Buffalo News, although I don't know where they actually got this article. It might be one of their writers, it might not. But, you know, would you, in Buffalo, I don't really know if you'd want to use the word folks. Would you call people, wouldn't you call them people? Wouldn't you call them, you know, hard-working industrial town, Western New Yorkers or something? But you wouldn't call them folks there.
I think folks is like a way to say, like, a nice way to say, like, stupid people. Or dumb people.
Punters.
Yeah.
If you're in Britain.
Come on, folks. Come on, stupid people. It's the same thing.
Fucking A.
Yeah.
they're still advertising Wicked on, well, I guess in Buffalo. I guess it's made its way to Buffalo.
It's coming. It's in Cleveland, too. So you know how many people have told me, oh, if you have not seen Wicked, you must see it. It's so good. You'll fall in love with the Wicked Witch. I'm like, I don't really want to fall in love with her, though.
No, no, no. Stop, please.
Oh, that sounds like somebody I know.
but you know, yeah, like, it was one of those things, like, there was a lot of discussion about Wicked in Chicago a few years ago.
Yeah.
Valley church pastor has been arrested, accused of dealing drugs, and he told detectives apparently he did it to bring people closer to God.
This news coming from the sheriff's office late tonight. Free TV's Jared Dillingham is live in Fountain Hills with details on how this guy allegedly hooked his clients. Jared.
Well, Carrie, what's more, the sheriff says this pastor was involved with a lot of the youth here in Fountain Hills. So as this investigation moves forward, a primary focus will be whether he was selling to minors as well as adults. We just got a picture of the 63-year-old pastor. His name is Mark Dirksen. He ran a church and a youth group here in Fountain Hills. The church called Faith Mountain Christian closed a while ago, but the pastor was still active here in the community, providing services and counseling, most recently in nursing homes. Acting on tips, MCSO sent undercover deputies into the pastor's apartment to try to buy drugs. And when they raided the place, they say they found heroin, methamphetamine, and prescription pills.
No marijuana?
What's more, this pastor's accused of doing it all right in the shadow of the MCSO substation here in Fountain Hills and the sheriff's own home.
But I could see my house from here anyway. And here we have this guy now blaming the city hall or the my office here, my sub office. Here's a guy selling drugs. We can see his house from here. That's how stupid he is. I mean, doesn't he see our patrol cars parked here?
So that's that statement funny, though. If they're calling him stupid for selling clothes to the cops, and aren't the cops stupid for not realizing this guy is selling shit right by their house?
I mean, that's a total idiot, a sheriff, for sure. Total moron.
The sheriff says something else which makes this case even more unique is the pastor would apparently give drugs away for free to hook people, and that's how he
developed come his on, case. Really?
It's a dare 101. The first one's free.
Yeah, that's only what they say in Dare. I'm sure it's all just bullshit. I'm sure it's all just propaganda and bullshit and lies. That, I mean, Arizona, come on, you know, like... That's a pretty twisted fucking place.
What's the relation with God so that they're gonna get high on meth and then develop a deeper relationship with God?
You know how people take ayahuasca or whatever and those like they do like ceremonies, you know, Brazilian, you know, style, you know, sacred ceremonies and stuff like that. Like, well, you know, I mean, methamphetamine, maybe it has use in sacred ceremonies of like the ancient, you know, hill tribes of southern Idaho. It's part of their culture.
I like that. That's that can happen.
Snappy Cam Pro.
Click, 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 click.
Yeah, so there's this app we finally tried. I think I mentioned it in a previous episode, but I hadn't really tried it much yet. So, yeah, it allows you to... you hold it down, and it takes a number of exposures, and you get to pick the best one. So sometimes when you have... like pets that are moving a lot, like our birds move pretty fast, so I've tried using it on them. And also, you know, like if you're taking pictures of groups of people, somebody's always doing something, so this gives you a series of exposures to choose from, and then you can like pick the one you want and save it.
It's great for the holidays and all those group shots and family shots, and you know, everybody gets antsy when they have to take it, you know, wait one more time, wait, don't leave. So you can get like 5 shots in one, you know, and you might get a really good one. And people who close their eyes a lot, like me.
Well, that's just very common with people, absolutely. People blink a good deal, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So it's cool to have. Well, you know, I thought that song was going pretty well, and that change there seemed a little strange.
Yeah.
So what, you know, I guess, like, there was, I had a time when I listened to some amount of David Bowie, but it was, like, 70s stuff. I like some of it. You know, he used to work with Brian Eno on, production, like, some of the 70s stuff. Low from the 70s by him is considered a classic by some people, but it's a little, I don't know. I'm not sure. It's that it's a little sluggish, that album. When you go back to some of the early 70s stuff, I do like some of the, like the Ziggy Stardust album. I like some of the stuff on there.
Yeah. I was just saying, he definitely has a unique sound. Yo's known as a David Bowie song.
Yeah, I think he had kind of a resurgence in the 90s. Like, people probably associate his 80s stuff with real... Well, you know what? There was that song with Queen that was good. But, like, then there's, like, stuff that's terrible, like Let's Dance. Like, that would be the late Bowie stuff that proved that he totally lost it. If there weren't stuff after that that I thought, like, is pretty good. I don't know if I've ever on this podcast shared my love of the 1995 David Bowie album, Outside. A very unique and strange album that never really got much recognition anywhere, I don't think, but... I think this is a real true collaboration with Brian Eno. So you know, it's had his vocals, but the instruments and arrangements have a kind of strange ambient quality through most of it. And so if you're a big Brian Eno fan, this is a pretty good album.
Are you a big Brian Eno fan?
Huge Brian Eno fan.
Yeah.
Brian Eno is, like, you know, maybe one of the, maybe the most important musician of the modern, is that too far, the most influential modern musician? I mean, it might sound like I'm overstating it, but his stuff, like Music for Airports in the 70s, totally changed, like, kind of conceptions of, you know, what was in the bounds of pop music. And, you know, like, I think the idea that music could be in the background to be listened to when one wanted to and then focus on a task, like, that wasn't in really the rock and roll tradition, right? Like, to me, I don't listen to a lot of classical music. So, I like jazz, but I don't really like classical, and a lot of people like to claim that that's a good music to have, like, on the background, whatever. Like, Brian Eno kind of showed that you can use electronic instruments, and you can use modern, you know, techniques and styles, and you can still act as a, you know, an instrumental background music, if that's what you want to do. So then, you know, there's stuff, if you go back far enough, he was kind of a glam rocker. So then, you know, he met up with Bowie, but as he collaborated with Bowie, he also did this solo stuff. So here's, like, Here Come the Warm Jets. This is from a very early album of his. This is basically the whole song, like... I think that, like, the level of influence of Eno on me, we consider that a lot of in the music that I make with you and stuff, like, a lot of the lack of convention in the songwriting, whether it's, like, just kind of strange repetition or not the traditional verse, chorus, verse structure or whatever. Like, in a post Brian Eno world, those are conventions.
Yeah. And it is. I mean, I think he's pretty influential, you know?
Sure. There's a lot of people. There's James Brown. There's, you know, John Lennon. There's, you know, Jimmy Page. There's Keith Richards. There's a lot of people that are massively influential. Janis Joplin. I mean, you know, there's a lot of people you could make a case for being one of the most influential people in the music, you know, world in the last, like, half century. John Coltrane. I mean, the list goes on. But, you know, Brian Eno would be in the conversation with those people. I, you know, Another Green World is something that is kind of another, this one has a lot of strange songs, but you know what people might remember, if you listen to this song, you might remember this from a movie, not this one. You got it. Very, very good. And is it like evocative, like to the point where you kind of think of that scene with Ewan McGregor's character Renton swimming, kind of surrealistic scene in there where like maybe in reality he's digging in the toilet for like the suppository or whatever, but
yeah.
But he's probably not actually swimming into the sewer system.
Right.
But in that surreal sequence with the light shining in to the toilet as he's swimming around, like, I guess it's a great illustration of just the filth of like a heroin based lifestyle.
Yeah.
And all, but then there, you know, in a contrast to that visual, right, you have this very gentle and ethereal. Beautiful ethereal mm-hmm. music. Absolutely. And yeah. This is actually, now here's where this music actually was inspired from. Brian Eno and some collaborators that he worked with at the time, including noted U2 producer Daniel Lanois and another guy, I think it was his brother, they watched the footage of the Apollo mission. So the album, the original album that song that's used in Trainspotting comes from, is called Apollo Atmospheres and Soundtracks. I think it was done in the 80s, but they had like, you know, whatever, like late 60s, early 70s footage of the trips to the moon by NASA. And they did this music based on, you know, inspiration from the video of going to the moon.
Wow, that's cool.
So there's other ambient tunes that go into it.
Yeah.
So basically it's a soundtrack to space travel.
Neat.
And the Chicago food community lost one of its most notable members. Charlie Trotter died at only 54 in Lincoln Park in Chicago a few days ago, and he was pronounced dead at Northwestern when they rushed him to the hospital and they found him unresponsive. Apparently, some sort of health problem. That's the rumor.
Yeah, it's too bad because he was a great chef and had a lot of influence on, you know, just like Brian, you know, with music, he did with the culinary scene.
It's hard to understate how influential he was in Chicago. I know the name and I don't know too much about the guy really because, I'm not a real expert on the cuisine, you know, scene in Chicago, but I gotta say, I think he was just a hugely influential name, and he helped put Chicago on the culinary map. I think, like, there's cities like Cleveland now that take a lot of pride as maybe sort of coming up in the culinary world with, you know, restaurants that are maybe, you know, pretty well-reviewed and maybe a little higher national profile. Chicago, I think, underwent a vaguely similar process about, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago. And this guy was maybe probably the prime mover in moving the city's image up to, you know, having some elite cuisine options and competing with the other big cities. The San Franciscos and the New Yorks and even, you know, whatever, the Paris's and Madrid's. Terms of, you know, cuisine and notable chefs, he was a really big name, you know, bigger than any one, you know, other chef probably in the city at the time. Now I did uncover some footage here This is, I don't know, from, I think not that long ago, but while his restaurant was still running, because he closed his restaurant like a year and a half ago. So here's a video of him at work once the dumb pre-rolls. We need like a sound to play during the pre-rolls.
Yeah.
This is a good sound. Okay, is that piano music?
Is everyone else? You know, actually, when you think about it, fine dining is probably the most accessible of all of the luxury experiences available. Fine dining really is a modest investment when you think of it, because you can go out with a significant other, a spouse, or a friend, and have a once-in-a-lifetime experience for a very modest price of $60 or $70 an hour. And you also have 70 or 80 people working on your behalf for $60 or $70 an hour. It's actually a bargain when you think about it.
Patrick, we got to get out of the window, please.
Yes, coming right now.
Greg, help keep it. I don't want anything in the window, please.
Come on. 2 people, 5, please. Position 1.
Chef, full steam ahead, please.
It's kind of interesting what happens behind the scenes. There's elements of athletics. It's very physical. You're running, you're moving quickly, you've got to coordinate your movements. But at the same time, it's maybe a little bit more choreographed. So it's almost like meshing a ballet with a professional basketball game at the same time.
All right.
We have raviolis, which are made out of butternut squash. And inside we have cashew and roasted squash with passion fruit vinaigrette and a spicy coconut emulsion. While we certainly look to Western Europe, that is to some extent France and Italy and Spain, simultaneously I'm actually more drawn to sort of an Asian minimalist approach, that is pristine, pure seafood and vegetables that are barely cooked and no cream or butter, and food that is sensually satisfying, but is at the same time very light and clean and very healthy. While I admire the paradigm of the French traditions and the Italian traditions and what goes on in Spain, it's mainly because of the time-honored traditions of what has happened there with food and wine together. And so I look at certain combinations that have existed historically, from Escoffier to Fernand Poin to Bocuse and beyond, and how these things came together, but mainly how they work with wine. Because we have an extraordinary wine collection, and we place a big emphasis on food and wine pairing.
What was that?
Here it's the red wine cellar. You have the white and champagne, and a white wine cellar upstairs that we keep all the Alsace wine, German wine, and Austrian wines. Over here it's like the most impressive collection, we can say. So you have Domaine Romani-Conti, 1945, and Chateau Lafite-Rothschild, 1870. And these are just two examples of the impressive collection of Chef Trotter.
We gotta go.
We're take 3 to 5. Orange is 6 o'clock.
Well, I don't come from a restaurant background. My family certainly wasn't, they were not restaurateurs or anything, far from it. In fact, they hated restaurants. But when I was a student at the university, I used to cook for my roommates, and one thing led to the next. And after I graduated, I said, yeah, I wanna be a cook. I wanna see where this goes, and began to work my way along, and so that was a long time ago.
Where's our lactose intolerant?
This is to the left, this is to the right, to the right, to the left. Well, I studied philosophy and political thought at the University of Wisconsin, and I didn't have a plan. I didn't dream of going to business school or law school or graduate school.
I
wasn't like that. I was more interested in the idea of studying the eternal truths. But then I was taken by gastronomy and cuisine and the physical nature and the sensual nature of cuisine, and so I was drawn to that, and as I say, once I was sucked in, I couldn't get out. It's like a calling. You have no choice. It chooses you. You don't choose it. My academic background is absolutely essential to what I do in the restaurant. I'm always an advocate of gaining knowledge from a variety of sources. Tiny Nantucket-based scallops from Massachusetts. We have Japanese Thai sea bream, which has been lightly steamed with Ocetra caviar, a white wine emulsion, and sunflower root.
Say what?
Yeah. It's almost like those like fine dining restaurants that they name things and you're just like, what is that?
Yeah, and everything has to be like, has to be derived from something else and made into a chutney. And...
or a gastrique or a foam or a root of something using parts that you don't normally use. Yeah. Well, rest in peace, Charlie.
Yeah, he had a good run, just not a very long run, as those things go. Now the Republicans run in the governor mansion of Virginia is over. Well, it didn't last very long. That shady guy Bob McDonnell, who took all those gifts, and his wife took all those money and gifts from a tobacco supplement. That whole thing. Well, there was an election for his successor, and it was Democrat Terry McAuliffe against Republican Ken Cuccinelli. Now, Cuccinelli is some crazy right-wing nutcase, you know, and fortunately, Terry McAuliffe won. And now the governor's mansion in Virginia is going to a Democrat again.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those states that's fairly even politically. It voted twice for Obama, but I think both times were a somewhat surprise. I think the second time it was a surprise. I think the first time Obama pretty much had it locked down. But, you know, because the first election, you remember, you know, North Carolina actually voted for Obama. But that was a long time ago now, you know. Like, a lot of, and most of those southeast states have gone hard right again.
Yeah. Especially after the first 4 years.
Well, yeah, they have all, and now they're, I mean, they've become known for all these voter ID, you know, laws that are discriminatory or at least unnecessary. And now, and all these extreme restrictions on a woman's right to choose. And they've elected a number of, like, right-wing, crazy, you know, governors, Nikki Haley in Carolina, and you know, people like that.
Yeah. Well, let's see what Virginia does then with their Democratic governor.
Yeah. Yeah, so okay, so there's a Linux story. You know, I haven't been running Linux because I, you know, just because of the computers we have now. We have like all Macs right now, which, you know, it's not like a, like some rule we have, but it's just the way our, you know, our systems are right now. The old one that I had been running Linux on, I stopped using that computer because it was, you know, so old. It couldn't even run the new some of the new distributions. Well, anyway, one of the things it couldn't run well was Unity by the Unity interface by Ubuntu. So Ubuntu changed. They were the first one. Like, they decided they're not going to use GNOME. GNOME was the most popular window manager kind of UI for Linux. You know, like, there was GNOME and KDE, right? And different distros, different distributions would have one or the other as the interface. And you'd seen, like, when I was running Linux on that older PC we had, there, like, for a little while I had KDE installed. Mostly the stuff that I ran was GNOME based, but that was the GNOME 2 era. GNOME 3 came along, and since you have a good eye for design and stuff like that, let me show you just like a Google image result of GNOME 2 and GNOME 3, and let me, you know, let you see the difference of what, you know, they're trying to do. Like, you see how GNOME 2 was very much a reaction to the Windows XP era. It had Windows, and it had, you know, icons, and it was, you know, it was a conventional 2000s desktop. GNOME 3 tried to push them into the future. But the problem was, this was the Linux community. It probably wasn't the right audience for it. And then Ubuntu, instead of working with the GNOME 3 people, they decided to do the thing they call Unity, which is maybe in some ways similar to GNOME 3, and it's definitely an attempt at evolution, but more and more now people are dropping GNOME. Like, at first, you know, Ubuntu decided, okay, well, maybe they wanted to control all the different layers more, so they wanted Unity, which is more under their control than GNOME. So, you know, people weren't sure what to think of that. But now, Debian, sort of the mother distribution of many distros, is switching to XFCE. Not Unity, but they're switching to another window manager, because, you know, there was GNOME and KDE, but there was also LXDE, I think, and then there's also this XFCE, and I've actually, you know, XFCE is good. Like, for a while, CrunchBang was using it, so, you know, it's a way you can make it very simple and minimal. It uses less resources, but, you know, for a long time, GNOME had been in the Debian, you know, in the Debian distribution. That had been the default interface, and Debian is a very big, you know, distribution that a lot of other people take and turn into their finalized distribution. So in a way, Ubuntu is based on it. In a way, Linux Mint is based on it. Like, a number of other ones. So it's a big change now. XFCE is their default instead of GNOME. So people, it's kind of like rats are running out of a sinking ship with GNOME.
Right.
And I guess the question is, you know, is this some sort of inevitable event? Does it have to do with the leadership of Karen Sandler, who took it over a couple years ago? And it's, I mean, I'm just saying, her tenure has kind of been coincided with it, you know, running into the ground in terms of its, you know, its uptake in distributions. I don't know. What do you think? Do you think they went in the right direction based on a very quick scan of the screenshots with GNOME 3? Or do you think they should have just kept it a little more, like, conventional?
This one looks more like a Mac to me, actually. You know, this GNOME 3.
Actually, you figured that's a great point. Actually, I've even heard it, like, put that the something like there was a reaction to Windows in the form of GNOME 2, and there was a reaction to Apple in the form of GNOME 3.
It looks nice.
Yeah, too bad nobody's really using it anymore.
Too bad.
So, Vignette is this app. It's for, like, recording Vine-style videos.
Yeah.
Yeah, I showed it to you.
Yeah.
What do you think of it?
The interface seemed a little clunky.
It's sort of based on Vine's interface, I guess. Yeah, it is a little clunky. It's basically this camera app that you can make square videos with real-time filters, and you can use a stopwatch kind of function where it'll record and then go off. You know, time-lapse function, and you can set how long the lapse is and then how long it records for.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, you're right. The interface, in terms of, you have to kind of hold it down and stuff. Funny. Have you used Vine much? Do you use Instagram video at all?
I don't do too much video.
No.
You know, I don't have the knack for capturing things on video like you do.
Do I?
Uh-huh.
What's the knack about doing that?
I mean, just knowing when to get your video camera out. You know, just knowing when something's going to happen. Like I said, I think, you know, there's just a magnetism about with you and video that you turn it on and stuff just happens. Or, you know, you're pretty quick at videoing things. And me, I don't know, not so much. I mean, I think I more see what's going on, and then by the time I think about getting out the camera and the video, it's already passed. So I go stick with photography because, no, that doesn't move as much.
I love your photography. You do really cool stuff. Yeah, you know, I guess I kind of go back and forth between wanting to do, like, you know, video and photography. You know, like, we're running, you know, it's already, there's a camera that Nikon did that they just released, and it is kind of designed like an old school Nikon camera, but it has a full frame sensor like the D4. It's like a $3,000 camera, but it's kind of crazy because it's like, you know how people love those old school DSLRs? Now, what I've read in, you know, like a preliminary review is that, you know, the reason that they don't look like that anymore is because they can mold the material at angles now, and they used to really have limitations about the shape they could make the cameras, and I don't know how true that is, but do you know what I mean? This thing does, it looks kind of like an old school, you know, like maybe what, 60s? It's designed to work with lenses that go back to like maybe like the 50s, wow. You know, like F-series. But I think you can use modern lenses too. It's sort of like a D4 in terms of the sensor. I think it's just called the Nikon F. And, you know, it's like, it's in some, in terms of the sensor, it is a modern digital D4 style sensor, full frame. Very nice. But the packaging, is classic Nikon, like 60s Nikon. I'm not sure about the exact eras, but that, I guess that's, isn't that sort of a 60s influence design, maybe?
It's 70s. Pretty slick looking. I wonder what it feels like in the hand.
Yeah, and this is the silver version. They also have a black one where it looks like more like a modern camera.
Yeah.
So if you get the silver finish, then you're really going with the retro look, which I think you kind of might as well almost with this camera, because it has a very retro kind of like styling outer body to it, with while still trying to be a really top-end modern one. But of course, you know, thousands of dollars, but pretty cool camera. And I guess if you just want a nice, slick, small, but very powerful full-frame DSLR, you know, that looks like a more modern conventional camera, it's amazing how much the dark finish, even because it looks like the silver finish is like shiny and the dark finish is like textured in areas.
Yeah.
So it's going to look a lot different.
You know, that's just, it's so interesting that there's this whole, you know, wave of nostalgia with photography. I mean, growing up and using that stuff, I love my digital camera, but there's this aesthetic that people want, you know, things to be old, but again, work like modern things. So.
Do you say you love your digital camera?
Yeah.
Like when you were growing up, like, when was the first time you had a digital camera?
No, I didn't have a digital camera growing up, but I loved, I used these, you know, film cameras that look like this.
Okay.
You know?
Oh, right, okay.
But I love my digital camera now.
Yeah, oh, you know? right, okay. Yeah, no,
because I don't understand this, like, wanting to go back to film, and I guess I was never a purist of whether it was film or not. I was more about capturing the image and anything that makes it easier to capture the image, I'm all for, and I think digital does that. But there's just this whole nostalgia about cameras, and you know, it, to me, it's hipster jewelry. You know, they just want to. I mean, that's totally like, I want to wear this around my neck and have people think I'm shooting with an old camera, but really I'm shooting modern things. I mean,
yeah, I think that I gotta say, at least this to me is the angle that makes, that's more sensible, as far as retro. You're still, instead of having something that may look retro or may not, but the results are decidedly retro because you have chemical film and you have to deal with that, and you don't have the ability to shoot in digital like raw and just be able to archive those and be ready to share and distribute and print and do all the stuff that you want to do with photos, like, you know, it's like, this at least gives you sensible results. Like you said, you know, it's just kind of like a hipster look to go around with it slung on your shoulder, but like, at least you get the modern, you know, results from the thing.
Yeah. It's very cool.
Well, thank you for joining me for the another episode of the Pacific Pelican.us/64 podcast.
Thanks for having me.
And this has been episode number 114, recorded November 9th, 2013. And, you know, thank you to our sponsor, the... I'm just gonna cut that out. I gotta go.